If you were to look at a list of where the last 25 Americans to win the Nobel Prize in Medicine got their undergraduate degree, you'd be surprised at what you'd find. Some of them went to Yale and Columbia and MIT, but some of them also went to DePauw, Holy Cross, and Gettysburg College. It's a list of good schools. Much the same thing holds true for the colleges of the Nobel Prize winners in chemistry. Harvard's on the list, but so are lots of schools that we don't think of as the best in the land. To be a Nobel Prize winner, apparently, you have to be smart enough to get into a college that's at least as good as Notre Dame or the University of Illinois. That's all. This is a radical idea, isn't it? Suppose that your teenage daughter found out that she'd been accepted at two universities, Harvard University and Georgetown University. Where would you want her to go? I'm guessing Harvard, because Harvard is a better school. Its students score a good 10 to 15% higher on their SATs, the dressed-up IQ test that virtually all American high school students have to take before applying to college. But given what we are learning about intelligence, the idea that students can be ranked, like runners in a race, makes no sense. Georgetown students may not be as smart on an absolute scale as the students of Harvard, but they are all clearly smart enough. And future Nobel Prize winners come from schools like Georgetown as well as from schools like Harvard. The psychologist Barry Schwartz recently proposed that elite schools give up on their complex admissions process and simply hold a lottery for everyone above the threshold. Put people into two categories, Schwartz says, good enough and not good enough. The ones who are good enough get put into a hat, and those who are not good enough get rejected. Schwartz concedes that his idea has virtually no chance of being accepted, but he's absolutely right. As Hudson writes, and keep in mind that he did his research at elite all-male English boarding schools in the 1950s and 1960s, knowledge of a boy's IQ is of little help if you are faced with a formful of clever boys. Let me give you another, perhaps more serious example of the threshold effect in action. The University of Michigan Law School, like many elite U.S. educational institutions, uses a policy of affirmative action when it comes to applicants from disadvantaged backgrounds. Around 10% of the students Michigan enrolls each fall are members of racial minorities, and if the school didn't significantly relax its entry requirement for those students, letting them in with lower undergraduate grades and standardized test scores than everyone else, it estimates that percentage would be less than 3%. Furthermore, if you compare the grades that the minority and non-minority students get in law school, the white students do better. That's not surprising. If one group has higher undergraduate grades and test scores than another, it's almost certainly going to have higher grades in law school as well. This is the reason why affirmative action programs are so controversial. In fact, an attack on the University of Michigan's affirmative action program recently went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It seems troubling for an elite educational institution to let in students who are less qualified than their peers. A few years ago, however, the University of Michigan decided to look closely at how the law school's minority students had fared after they graduated. How much money did they make? How far up in the profession did they go? How satisfied were they with their careers? What kind of social and community contributions did they make? What kind of honors had they won? They looked at everything that could conceivably be an indication of real-world success. And what they found surprised them.